Ever get that feeling? You know, like you're drowning in a sea of data, just overwhelmed by ones and
Oh,
zeros.
absolutely. It's a common feeling these days. Data is everywhere.
Exactly. So today, we're throwing you a life preserver, bloom filters.
Ah, bloom filters. An elegant solution for a messy problem.
Now, I know what you might be thinking. Bloom filters. Sounds a bit technical, right? But trust me, this isn't some dry computer science lecture. This is about managing massive amounts of information efficiently, something I know you're interested in.
Absolutely. And bloom filters are one of those elegant solutions that, once you understand them, seem almost magical.
Okay, so let's break it down. How do bloom filters actually work?
Think of it like this. Instead of storing every single piece of data directly, a bloom filter uses a much smaller fingerprint.
A fingerprint. Okay, I like where this is going.
Right. So this fingerprint is represented by bits, those ones and zeros. Imagine a row of lights, each one representing a bit. When you add a piece of data to the filter, you use special functions called hash functions to choose which lights to turn on.
So instead of storing the entire data, we're storing a simplified representation, a kind of digital fingerprint.
Exactly. Now, when you want to check if a specific piece of data exists, you use those same hash functions to see which lights should be on. If any of them are off, you know for sure the data isn't there.
That's incredibly clever, a super fast check-in system. But what if two different pieces of data happen to turn on some of the same lights?
That's the trade-off we make for this efficiency, and you've hit upon the concept of false positives.
False positives. So there's a chance the filter might say an element is present when it's actually not.
Exactly. It's like, imagine two people with the same birthday. They might share a birthday cake, but they're not the same person.
Right. Okay, so there's a small chance of these false positive hiccups. But overall, bloom filters offer a super efficient way to manage data, especially when we're talking about massive data sets.
You got it. And they're used everywhere. Spam filters, internet routers,
Yeah.
things that deal with tons of data very quickly.
They use minimal space, give us lightning-fast results. It almost sounds too good to be true. So, what's the catch?
Well, you've highlighted the strengths beautifully. But there is a limitation with traditional bloom filters.
Uh-oh. I knew there had to be one somewhere.
To achieve this efficiency, we need to know in advance the maximum size of the data set we're dealing with.
Really? So, it's like building a bookshelf, but we need to know exactly how many books we'll ever own before we bell it.
That's a great analogy, and that's where the problem lies.
That does seem like a rather big limitation. What happens if our data outgrows our perfectly sized bloom filter?
Unfortunately, with a traditional bloom filter, you'd have to start from scratch, build a whole new, bigger one.
Ouch. Not ideal.
Not at all. But don't worry, that's where the innovation of scalable bloom filters comes in. They bring an entirely new level of flexibility to the table.
Okay, now we're talking adaptability.
Precisely. Scalable bloom filters allow us to handle constantly growing data sets without breaking a sweat.
This is where it gets really interesting. We'll dive into the magic of scalable bloom filters and how they overcome this limitation right after the break. Welcome back. Before the break, we were diving into bloom filters, those awesome digital fingerprint systems, remember?
Right, for managing those huge data sets.
Yeah, exactly. But we hit a bit of a snag, didn't we? That whole needing to know the data size up front thing.
Yeah, that's a big one. Like trying to build a house with no idea how many rooms you'll eventually need.
Right, a real-world problem. So, how do scalable bloom filters fix this? Do they have some crystal ball for our data?
Huh, I wish. No, but they are designed to adapt and grow. See, instead of one fixed size bloom filter, they use a series of them.
Okay, so multiple bloom filters, how does that help?
Well, each one is progressively larger and more precise than the last.
So it's like starting with a small bookshelf and adding bigger ones as your library grows.
Exactly. And as data comes in and the first filter fills up, the scalable bloom filter kicks in. It automatically creates a new, bigger filter with a tighter error probability, fewer
Ooh.
of those false positives.
Ah, so it's getting smarter too as it grows. Like each new bookshelf comes with a more organized librarian.
Exactly. And the best part, these multiple bloom filters, they're linked together. So the system always checks the newest, most accurate one first, then works backwards if it needs to.
Oh, that's pretty neat. So even if our data goes crazy big, we've got this system that keeps getting more precise.
Exactly. Maintaining a low error rate across the board, like a well-oiled machine, even as the workload increases.
I'm starting to see why they're called scalable. But how do we fine-tune all of this? How big should each new filter be? How do we control those errors? It seems like there are a lot of variables.
You're right. And that's where the Asymptote parameters come into play.
Okay, E and R. Sounds a little cryptic. What do those do? All right, so we've got these scalable bloom filters growing alongside our data like some kind of digital garden. But where do E's and R fit into all of this?
They're like the control knobs for fine-tuning this whole system.
Okay, I'm picturing myself at a giant control panel now. What exactly am I adjusting with E's?
E's is all about growth. Think of it as the scaling factor. It determines how much bigger each new bloom filter is compared to the one before it.
So if we crank up the E's, we're basically saying, we're expecting a lot more data, let's make these filters grow faster.
Exactly. Let's say E's is set to 2. That means every new filter will be twice the size of the previous one.
Ah, so it's like doubling the size of our bookshelf each time? Makes sense. What about R? That was the error thing, right?
Yes. R is the error probability ratio. It controls how much the error probability decreases with each new filter added to the chain.
Okay, so a lower R means we're getting stricter with those false positives. Like, each new librarian we hire is even more meticulous about putting books back in the right spot.
Precisely. And a higher R would mean those librarians might be a bit more relaxed, potentially leading to a few more misplaced books.
Right, so it's all about finding a good balance then. Like, we don't want to be adding huge new filters every 5 minutes if our data isn't growing that fast.
Absolutely. It's a trade-off. Lower R for better accuracy might mean using more space because we're adding filters more frequently. Higher R might save space, but at the risk of more errors.
So how do we know what values to use? It seems like it could get complicated pretty quickly.
Well, that's where research like this paper is so helpful. The authors really dug into the relationship between SR and overall performance, and they actually found some pretty interesting things. For example, for a lot of common applications, an ES of 2 or 4 works really well.
Really? So starting with 2 or 4 fours is a good rule of thumb.
It's a good starting point, yeah. It lets the filter adapt without going overboard on creating new filters.
Makes sense. And what about picking the right R? Any pointers there?
One interesting thing they found is that even a slightly higher R, like between 0.8 and 0.9, can be surprisingly effective.
Really? That feels a little counterintuitive.
It does. But remember, it's about the long game. A slightly higher R early on can actually save a lot of space down the line, especially if we're aiming for a really low error rate overall.
Wow. It's like we're uncovering these hidden levers of data management. All these little tweaks can make a big difference.
Exactly. It's not just about memorizing magic numbers, but understanding these underlying principles. Then you can really fine-tune these powerful tools to fit your specific needs.
This is why I love these deep dives. You learn something new every time.
Me too. Always exciting to see how these theoretical concepts play out in practice.
Absolutely. So we started with bloom filters, those digital fingerprint systems for managing tons of data, right?
Right. And then we discovered their even more impressive cousins, scalable bloom filters.
The ones that can grow and adapt with our data, no crystal ball required.
Exactly. And we've learned how those key parameters, L's and R, give us the control to optimize this whole system.
It's like we've learned how to build not just a library, but a library that can grow and evolve with the ever-expanding universe of information. And on that note, we've reached the end of our deep dive. But remember, the learning doesn't stop here. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and until next time.